talking, and then maybe we could continue the discussion in this broader format. So this talk is not a typical seminar. I'm not here to present one or two of my latest and greatest results. Specifically, it's sort of a pseudo-random stroll through a list of topics I'm working on and some of the... I mean, I'm in a very unusual place right now. I mean, the research I've been working on for 20 years is now hyper-relevant to policy and commercialization and so on. So I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on in that space in quantum computing as well. And there will be the occasional deep dive into mathematics and... but don't hesitate to interrupt, and there's a big chalkboard, as you know. So, you know, quantum computing, when we were, started a quantum computing group here in 1999, and we were assuring people this is going to be an important thing someday, and we sincerely believed it. I didn't expect it to happen as soon as it's happening, but the application areas we've known about in designing new quantum materials, testing the behavior of drugs at the quantum level or the production of fertilizers and so on, optimizing general industry optimization problems, or shorter term, using the same quantum technology for advanced sensing and so on, secure communication. These are the application areas we know this new harnessing this new quantum paradigm will bring, but of course, I'm sure we're just scratching the surface. And so in cryptography, which is, as an undergrad, I worked in conventional cryptography. I worked in mathematical algorithms to try to break what's known as the discrete logarithm problem. And then I reluctantly acknowledged that these quantum devices would break them much more easily. That's the angle I came in. But harnessing quantum mechanics gives us a whole new, I don't want to overuse the term, but it is a new paradigm for cryptography. It rewrites the rules, what's possible, what's not possible, and allows new cryptographic tools that we previously, actually in a classical context, may well be impossible to become possible. And technology is starting to catch up with the theory in a couple areas. In many areas, you need a full-fledged quantum computer, stable quantum memory you can carry around in your back pocket. We're not there yet. But in other cases, you don't. So first generation tools are quantum random number generation. And there's different grades of quantum random number generators in terms of their sort of certifiability, right? You can just say, well, this process was quantum. It produced some random bits. Surely those are good bits. Okay, that's sort of the lowest grade. Where there was real entropy generated because there's something quantum going on, but of course there's something quantum always going on. To the very, very top grade where you have space-like, well, not space-like, but you have physically isolated Alice and Bob violating Bell inequalities, and then you can, in a sense, certify that the resulting random bits really are random with some very, very, very minimal set of assumptions. There always has to be some assumptions. And then you have everything in between.
Oh, bless you.
And then industry is starting to commercialize them. And again, some of these are a little more, the first generation, the high bit rate products are not the most paranoid certifiable random bits you can get. They're still probably far better than anything else on the market. But if you're super paranoid about your randomness, now most people say, most people don't need very good randomness. You just need okay randomness. As long as there isn't, it's not, deterministic and isn't designed by somebody who's trying to thwart whatever it is you're doing, you're fine. But in cryptographic applications, there is an adversary trying to subvert whatever it is you're doing. So there actually, believe it or not, there really is a market for better random number generators. And bad random number, like really bad random number generators, have been the cause of some serious, vulnerabilities on the internet.
Would you talk about how to quantify that, or
what? You quantify good randomness?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean there's a number of. There's the typical industry thing is there's some statistical tests, and if it passes those tests, it meets a certain standard, but. If you're really paranoid and you're a physicist, you could say, Well, basically, you could do space-like separation, but that's an overkill. You have two pieces of hardware you assume are not communicating secretly to each other through some back channel, and use entanglement. And if you send these entangled particles, the catch is you have to pick a random basis. Wait a minute, where did you get the randomness for the, you know? So it's a form of randomness expansion. And the idea that I had and others had was maybe we could just use a few bits of randomness to pick the bases. And then if you pass the tests, the statistical tests, then you have a theorem that says with probability 1 minus 1 over 2 to the 100, these bits truly are random. And then, again, there's physical assumptions, like these things aren't secretly communicating to each other. You're not divulging the bits, you know, to your adversaries, some very, very basic things. And then you get provable randomness in that sense. The bandwidth, you know, the rate of generation is very low because we don't have good random number source, entanglement sources. And then you have everything in between.
Can we get the numbers that you generate that are...
It's an arbitrarily long stream of... Mm. You can get kilohertz or megahertz rate of bit generation. So as big of a number as you'd ever want.
The biggest loss here is just a rate of random generation.
Yeah.
That's the...
Yeah.
Because I can throw dice, but like this is so much faster.
Yeah. And then, you know, you can throw dice, but then there's bias, you know. You could say, well, it's not much, sure, but 0.50001 is something that can be exploited in some cases, if there's any bias at all, or correlations. So there's random number generators, and there's a growing industry, and they're making them smaller, faster, cheaper, et cetera, et cetera. I keep reminding them, and secure, but and there is also a trade-off on the security curve. I think more... that's a very... Random numbers are very, very... You can't do crypto without random numbers. One almost as fundamental as the establishment of keys. I won't say too much about how quantum key establishment works. I mean, I can, but the basic idea is... You exploit the uncertainty principle. I prepare a bunch of random bits, quantum bits, right? In a continuum, or it doesn't have to be a continuum, actually, just some non-orthogonal bases. I send them through an untrusted channel to you, and then you measure them on a random basis. We have a public but authentic conversation about what you sent and what you got. We sample a very, very sparse subset of the quantum bits. And we can verify, we can approximate, like rigorously, how much eavesdropping occurred. Because the uncertainty principle tells us that if there's this much disturbance, if there's this much extraction of information, there must be this much disturbance. And then you can do statistics to say, you know, you can do statistical inference to say, well, this is how much disturbance we detected. Therefore, with probability delta, the adversary has at most epsilon information. And you can pick delta to be exponentially small and epsilon to be exponentially small. And the rest is just details, right? And there's countless, you can have Alice send photons to Bob, or you can have Bob send photons to Alice. You can have an entangled source out in the cloud sending photons to Alice and Bob. So Alice and Bob just have to receive. And the source can actually be an untrusted service provider. Or better yet, because detectors are hard to protect, Alice and Bob could send photons into the cloud, measures them in an entangled basis, and broadcasts the measurement results. That also works. That's a sufficient quantum channel between Alice and Bob. The beauty of the entanglement-based approach is you can farm out your quantum channel to an untrusted adversary. And it's their job to do the quantum repeater, to get it, you know, to do all the hard part, the physics and engineering. You don't have to try, and you don't have to trust them, amazingly. We're not there yet. What we have right now is point-to-point links, and where you trust, you know, if your adversary is attacking the links, you're safe. But you have to trust the people running the nodes and sort of somehow repeating the keys. And China has a 2,000-kilometer project and many other sub-networks they're working on. There's one in Switzerland. And other places. So it's right now, it went from a point-to-point solution, which meant you have, you know, one bank 20 kilometers to their backup station, they encrypt that. That's a very, very, very niche market. to a trusted repeater network, which could be an entire city. Nobody's, to my knowledge, nobody's really using this yet, but the market is bigger in that you can have governments or banks where they do have trusted locations that they physically protect. So it's a reasonable model. In fact, people aren't so averse to the trusted repeater model. There is a non-trivial market. But ultimately, our real ambition is to have a quantum internet where any two parties, you know, at their endpoints, and you let the service provider, the network providers, worry about transmitting the photons somehow. You just have to either send or receive and measure photons locally. So it's a very exciting era. Again, several companies, actually I'd forgot about this company. So that I invited three companies to a workshop I had in London last week, and this was the fourth one I forgot to invite. We couldn't fit them all in, but there's four companies in China alone, several in Europe, working on quantum cryptography as well. In Australia.
So they're trying to commercialize photography.
Yeah.
So there are people that buy this?
Yes. No, it's a good question. I mean, that's part of my... I'll get to that, okay. Those debates. So, okay. Like in China, I think the government decided this was important. And so now there's a lot of money on the table from the financial sector and the government sector to buy a lot of these boxes. We hope this push, this proactive push, will gain momentum and stay. But security does need a push, I would say, a regulatory push at least. And they're getting money as well. Yeah. So, but it's a very good question whether there really is going to be a market for this. I think there should be, and I'll discuss that a bit more later. Because there's an alternative that's cheaper and easier.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah,
and that's, you know, the lowest common denominator may prevail. But I've been pushing hard, and that's why one of the reasons I had this workshop last week. So it's important when we're talking about quantum computers to delineate that there's two general flavors of quantum computers. There's the ones you hear a lot about in the media, you know, the D-Wave and others. And they're not pretending to be fault tolerant. Okay? They're saying, I'm going to have a bunch of quantum bits on a chip. They're not completely noisy. There's something quantum going on. And we hope they solve something useful. Right? So the important thing for cybersecurity, we don't know how to use these devices to cryptanalyze anything. Of course, maybe they can be, but that's not good enough. Right? So they're not a known threat. Can they capture some of the power of quantum computation? Well, maybe. Maybe a tiny bit. At the very least, can they simulate themselves faster, better than a conventional computer? If they can't, well, then there's no business case to build these devices, right? Okay, so if there's nothing quantum, if there's nothing quantum going on inside, well, then they're definitely not going to be useful from a quantum computing perspective. And just because you have something quantum going on inside doesn't mean you're an interesting computer. You could just be a really good quantum random number generator, not good for computation. So can they at least simulate themselves better than a classical computer? We don't even know that this is a yes. I think this is a maybe. Michael Jarrett, is one of the world experts on this question here. And let's hope the answer is yes. But can they do anything useful that people actually pay money for, right? I don't know, maybe. The Creative Destruction Lab is part of the Rotman School at the University of Toronto. They have a program dedicated, the quantum machine learning program, dedicated to see if people are willing to start companies to try to commercialize, D-Wave and other early generation computing platforms. I'm one of their I met them and I kind of told them what I thought about how risky this was. And then I thought they'd never talk to me again, but they invited me to one of their advisors. So I'm talking to, I think they at least intellectually understand the risk. And I try to remind them that there is a risk and suggest ways to de-risk it. So this is, for cybersecurity, this is a big distraction. It's good in the sense that it raises awareness of quantum, but then when I have to spend the next 10 minutes explaining that it's not a real threat and I don't find it terribly useful. Other people are more opportunistic and just take advantage of this to say, yeah, quantum's coming, we're all gonna die unless you do what we say. but I prefer a more, I don't know, truthful approach. So, but then there's a scalable fault-tolerant quantum computer, right? This is the one that, you know, achieves fault tolerance and solves all the problems we know, you know, simulations and optimization and so on. These are definitely a known threat to cybersecurity. So I'll talk a little bit about what we know they're good for, because for the most part, if you take a random problem, a quantum computer doesn't help. It's a very, very, very special hammer. And it only, you know, works on very specific nails that we haven't even, I think, finished discovering. So David Deutsch proposed a problem. So we have a function that maps one bit to one bit. You want to know, is it constant or not? So does it always output 0 or always output 1? Or does it give different outputs? So there's only 4 functions. The constant 0 function, the constant 1 function, the identity function, or the not function that outputs the opposite. So the question is it the identity or not, or is it one of the constant functions? Now, on a classical device, you have to evaluate the function of both inputs if you want to know the answer to that. There's no shortcut. David came up with an algorithm, and it was probabilistic. We made it deterministic. It's really simple. You know, there's a gate. You prepare on your input qubit, you prepare 0 plus 1. So you have 2 qubits. And the second one, you prepare 0 minus 1. That's what the Hadamard just prepares, 0 plus 1. Right? And then after this controlled F, this is just shorthand for evaluating. It just maps. Sorry, X, 0. It evaluates your function on these 2 bits. Instead of putting a definite, your workspace in a definite 0, make it 0 minus 1. The net effect is it computes the function in the relative phases. Well, it computes a function in the phases. So your top bit is 0 plus or minus 1. And it's 0 plus 1 if f at 0 equals f at 1. And it's 0 minus 1 if f at 0 is not f at 1. So now your problem has become, can I distinguish 0 plus 1 from 0 minus 1? Because if it's constant, you have 0 plus 1 in the top bit. And if it's not, you have 0 minus 1. And the Hadamard, I mean, in quantum computer science, we apply the Hadamard transformation, which maps 0 plus 1 to 0 and 0 minus 1 to 1. So certainly if we can't, you know, we can certainly mathematically, we know we can distinguish 0 plus 1 from 0 minus 1 and certainly build a quantum computer to do that as well. So with one shot, you can solve something that classically needs 2 implementations. Yep?
Sorry, I just missed, technically speaking, what this diagram means. Because you say you use f only once, but you're applying it to what state?
You're applying it to 2 qubits, so the time flows, you know, left to right in these circuits. You prepare the first bit qubit in 0 plus 1, the second one in 0 minus 1. Then you apply this unitary that evaluates f. That leaves the input bit alone, the first bit alone, but flips the second bit depending on what f at x is. So if f at x is 1, 0, 1, minus 1 goes to 0, to 1 minus 0. So it picks up a phase of minus 1. Right? That's why.
It gets fed to the top bits.
Well, it doesn't. It effectively does. Like, people think, oh, wait a minute, well, the information is moving. Well, not really. But, I mean.
No, it's just. Line.
Of this line? This means.
The one, the vertical one, the time to
go. So,
the one that connects that one. That one.
That oh, this is just shorthand for this unitary here.
Oh, I see.
So you have an interaction which computes the function.
So then it's a tensor product, the upper and lower line, or is it
yeah.
An entangle?
Yeah, so the, oh yeah, I have a big whiteboard here. So ignore the H's. That middle part, you have 0 plus 1 tensor, 0 minus 1 going in. Okay.
Again. Sorry, I know that slide, by the way.
Sorry?
Because there's a 0, 0 plus 1.
Plus yeah, the 0 after the Hadamard becomes a 0 plus 1. So the, this, so at this point in time, before this function is applied, the top qubit is 0 plus 1, the bottom qubit is 0 minus 1. And you can rewrite this as 0 tensor 0 minus 1 plus 1 tensor 0 minus 1. And then when you apply the function, right, if f at, so it computes f at 0 and adds it to these bits. So 0 goes f at 0 and 1 goes to 1 plus f at 0. So if f at 0 is 0, nothing happens. If f at 0 is 1, these get switched. But that's just effectively a sign change. And tensor products, well, don't care. I mean, it's a scalar, right? So you might as well write it in front, right? It's just bookkeeping. There's nothing physical. The information isn't physically moving. And the same thing in this branch of the wave function. It picks up a phase, or not, right? It picks up a phase of minus 1 or plus 1, depending on what f at 1 is. So this is what happens in the two slices of the wave function. Now, of course, you can factor, you can rewrite this as minus 1 to the f at 0, 0, plus minus 1 to the f at 1, 1, tensor 0 minus 1. So that second qubit, you know, is an eigenstate. It doesn't change. It's sort of a catalyst. It's kind of workspace that lets you do something interesting. So by using quantum states, by not restricting to classical basis state 0, 1, 1, 0, but allowing these superpositions, one implementation of f gives you this state here, which is either 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1, depending on whether f is constant. And so then you're just one, you know, rotation and measurement away from learning if f is constant or not. And just about nobody cared when he came up with this, right? But Bazzarani cared, and with one of his students, Ethan Bernstein, they used the same tools and extended them and will develop them further, and said, generalized to this problem. I have f, which maps n-bit strings to 0 or 1. Right? And I have a black box. I have a process that computes f at x in this way, but in a very special way, where f at x is the inner product of a and x. The string, these, you know, you just take the first bits and the second bits, multiply them, and then add them all up. So just the dot product of these two strings modulo 2. And they said, determine a. The string A. Now, classically, you need n evaluations. Quantumly, you can do it in one shot by a very similar method. So that was super interesting for about 5 people in the world, right? And then Dan Simon, who is a postdoc, he did his PhD with Charlie Rakoff at Toronto, who's a bit of a quantum computing skeptic, ironically. Then he went to work with Gilles Brossard at Montreal, and he built on these tools and solve this problem. You have a function that maps n-bit strings to some finite set. F at x is f at y if and only if this, you know, x, so think of z2 to the n as an additive group, modulo 2 over the, this is an additive group. F at x equals f at y if and only if x and y are in the same coset of some hidden subgroup of Z2 to the n. And you have a way of implementing f. Now, classically, we know this takes an exponential number of evaluations of f to find what this hidden subgroup is, or if it even exists. Like, you could say, alternatively, f is just a one-to-one function. But he came up with an algorithm that makes on the order of n evaluations of f. So exponential speed up. Again, nobody cared. It was rejected from one of the top computer science conferences. Applications, one of the first applications, you know, This colleague said Bernstein Vazirani's problem looked contrived to him, but Simon's problem, he thought, looked natural, by one of the few people who thought so. And that inspired Shor's polynomial time factoring algorithm and discrete log algorithm. And these are two problems that underpin internet security. So that's just the way research goes. You have people exploring very esoteric things that look completely contrived. But they're mining. They're looking for, you know, deep ideas. I mean, I know I'm preaching to the, you know, some of the most fundamental researchers in the world, but I think this is a nice story to tell, to say, don't mess with fundamental research, because you wouldn't get good applied research if they didn't have something to apply. So let the fundamental people find where, you know, mine for the very fundamental results. And then there's another application in some breaking symmetric key cryptography, another paper that nobody knew about or cared about, but then our colleagues in France generalized it. This makes us a bit nervous. They're starting to, I guess I won't get into, they're able to break certain symmetric cryptography in a certain model, a model that's not realistic, but it's useful for proving things. So it's a real nuisance, because it's a really nice model to prove things are secure. But just because you can't prove it's secure in that model doesn't mean it's not secure. It just means you have to come up with new proof tools. But
what do you mean by model?
Like, often what we do in cryptography is, you know, here's the real deal, but I don't know how to prove something's impossible. But I'll actually give the adversary more power to have a cleaner mathematical problem to solve, to prove.
So the real deal would be you have some set of operations that you do, and some set of operations that...
Yeah. So I'll explain what the difference is. So what we do is we assume that the system will very kindly in cryptography you have, you know, plain text attacks. So you assume the adversary gives you a message, you encrypt it for the adversary and give it back to the adversary, and you say, prove that the adversary can't break your code, can't decrypt any other message other than the ones you they gave you, even though they have any polynomial number of such chosen plain text. Or you want to say, with 2^40 chosen plain text, you still can't break the system.
So they're given 2^40 Rosetta stones.
Yeah. Right.
Is a book, is an encrypted book.
Yeah.
Given an arbitrary number of those.
Yeah. Then you prove they still can't do anything.
They still can't extract information.
Yeah. And if you do that, you say, well, that's really good. My system is secure. So in quantum, we said, okay, we will let the adversary give you a superposition of messages, and then you return the superposition of ciphertext. And then that was kind of a natural, that's more than would really happen. But if you can prove it's secure in that model, then I'm pretty happy. They broke the systems in that model, allowing, you know, giving your adversary the superposition query power in some cases was too much. So it's a bit of a nuisance. You can heavy-handedly say, well, I will always measure, you know, every message before I encrypt it, and you can force it to be classical. But then you have to actually do it or believe that it's happening on your behalf. Which is not a huge, like, people aren't super worried about this, but if you can imagine someday where everything's up in the quantum cloud and somebody else is doing the computations for you, like, are you sure they're not? And I mean, it could have other implications for more complicated systems where these are problems within a problem. Anyway, so this is an unexpected thing that grew out of this result. Lots of generalizations to Simon's problem, which I won't get into, but one called the hidden subgroup problem. But slight generalization of Simon's problem allows you to solve this problem. Now, we know from group theory that any finite abelian group is a direct sum of finite cyclic groups. That's nice. If you could easily compute this decomposition, you could break RSA already. Right? So finding the direct sum of the finite cyclic groups is non-trivial in some cases. Right? But these extensions of Shor's algorithm make it easy. And this has been applied in other instances now in quantum algorithms. I'll skip this one. This is another way to establish keys. Right, the clock does not work. That one's not going to work. I'll be here long. So we can generalize it. We can also, you know, finitely generated abelian groups can be thought of as integer lattices. But there's other problems. You could also think of real number lattices. And there's a lot of important number theory problems that can be formulated as finding hidden sublattices of real lattices, such as solving Pell's equations and the principal ideal problem and so on. And there's quantum algorithms that vastly outperform the known classical alternatives for these problems as well. Also quantum searching. This is another well-known, this is one of the first speed-ups we came up with. Well, Lovgrover came up with. You have a function you can efficiently compute, and it evaluates a 0 or 1, right? So it's a needle in a haystack type problem. You want to find the x such that f at x is 1, right? And x could be a valid proof for the theorem you're trying to prove. F is the automated theorem checker, right? So this is a very powerful thing to be able to invert an arbitrary Boolean function. Among many things, you could break a code, right? Once you have the secret keys, you can verify you have the secret keys. So we get a quadratic speed up for this. So instead of 2 to the n guesses, which is what you need to do classically, you only need 2 to the square root of 2 to the n. So huge potential application space. There's certain limitations to how much you can parallelize it, and I'll skip that part.
Could you use a quantum cryptography regime without having with a classical computer? In a way, just for exchange information securely between, just have something done in the classical computation, you have some answer from that.
So you mean skip quantum device. Yeah. So I'll get to that. These algorithms for symmetric. So there's symmetric key crypto and public key crypto. Symmetric key crypto is the stuff that's been around for millennia, where two parties share a secret. Like it's a recipe for scrambling and unscrambling, and they share the same secret, and one scrambles, the other unscrambles. So that's been around a long time, and we use it today. Like when you go to Amazon to do online shopping. You authenticate with public key crypto. You establish a secret key with public key crypto. But then when you're encrypting your credit card, that's with the symmetric key cryptography, like AES.
That relies on trusted third party, right?
No. Well, okay. Public key crypto relies on sort of trusted people called certificate authorities. So you have to trust that your browser has a valid Microsoft certificate on it. Otherwise, every auto update for Microsoft could be fake. So but you're trusting authenticity, not secrecy. So
you're communicating secretly with whoever it is on the other end.
Yeah.
So no, initially, what's already in existence is an authentication infrastructure. There's no secrets. Well, the secrets are the private keys. But Microsoft's public key is not a secret. Amazon's public key is not a secret. Perimeter's public key is not a secret. In fact, you want it out there, and you're trusting that people have authentic copies of these certificates. Actually, the whole infrastructure of people vouching for other people's certificates and so on. It's a weak link in the security infrastructure, to be honest, but we do rely on Microsoft, VeriSign, Amazon, Apple, that your browser is the correct certificate. Because if your IT person went and installed fake certificates, then they could fake to be Microsoft and install any malware they want on your device. So that's the trust background for public key crypto. And one of the tools of public key crypto is to establish symmetric keys, which you can now use to communicate secretly. We have good symmetric key crypto. Doesn't need a quantum, we don't need QKD to do encryption. In fact, there really is, we don't need quantum to do encryption. What we need quantum for is to establish keys. So one of the things I work on is, what are the best? So quantum computers can quadratically attack these schemes. So if you have 128 bits of security, that means 128-bit key for AES, for encryption. That means you have to do the best known algorithms do 2 to the 128 work to break them. In theory, a quantum computer can do 2 to the 64 work to do it. But what is it really, right? And so we actually did cost estimates based on best known error correction and so on. And, for these 256-bit secure schemes, the security really is closer to something like 146 bits or 166 bits. And I'll tell you a little bit about all the tools that we need, all the reduction steps. You have to actually, you know, it's part of my team's work. We look at the implications of these quantum algorithms to solve problems we hope are the basis of quantum-resistant cryptography. So instead of factoring or discrete logarithms, finding short vectors in a lattice is a promising problem. You can break the problem, it's just really hard, so you have to estimate how big of a lattice do I need to pick so no one could ever break it in a reasonable amount of time. And you have to apply the best known quantum algorithms to that problem. And that's hard, actually. It's a bit messy. You have to understand the quantum algorithms. You have to understand the classical algorithms, combine them. So we did some work on this. A new algorithmic paradigm. So how do we come up with algorithms? Well, we try really, really hard. So sometimes we invent new algorithms. Sometimes we invent paradigms for finding algorithms. And quantum walks are sort of the quantum analog of Markov chain-based algorithms. I won't get into detail into how they work, but it's a wonderful new paradigm that has borne a lot of fruit. And one of my former students and other colleagues showed how you can speed up some subset sum problems. It didn't break the schemes. It just meant you pick keys that are 25% bigger, which is not a big deal if you know about it in advance. If you find out about it after you've picked your keys, deployed, and encrypted, and then found out, oh, actually, you should have had slightly bigger keys, it's a problem. So we do need now to study the best known attacks to some of these new mathematical problems. The problem is nobody's working on this. Like, there's no incentive for quantum algorithms people to try to break these alternative classical crypto systems, because they'll probably fail. I mean, these are deliberately chosen to be problems that we don't think there's a quantum attack. So why would a good master's or PhD student try to attack them?
In other words, these are classical crypto schemes,
yeah,
which are quantum resistant.
We hope. But it's a big hope, because...
But there's well-reasoned hope.
Yeah, so their hope, because the known quantum algorithms don't work. So then everyone's like, great, they're quantum secure because they're safe against algorithms that weren't designed to break these systems. I mean, to me, that's not a big reassurance. It's a bare bones. I mean, that's a necessary but far from sufficient condition, that you're resilient to the existing cryptanalytic tools.
Is there any sort of information theoretical approach to sort of say, it's very naively speaking, but if I had sort of maximal quantumness in some sense. Is there some quantum version of like a magical Turing machine or whatever, where I can throw it at a classical algorithm and see if even in principle it could be amenable to being broken in this fashion? Is there any sort of abstraction like that exists?
People have tried, yeah. But none of it's necessary or sufficient at the end of the day. But people have certainly tried, like,
you know, don't even know that P is not equal to MP, so all these could be classically broken. A classical computer could break all of these crypto systems. We just maybe don't know the algorithm yet. So we certainly
okay,
but
that's the that you can assume.
Oh yeah, okay, but we don't know that.
Sure. I guess that's my question. Like if P or MP is assumed, then...
But then even then, you can't prove that this thing is...
So if you could prove in any... You know, if you could prove rigorously that a problem is quantum hard, you would separate P from P space, which isn't quite P, does not equal NP, but pretty damn close. So it's let's just say some of the smartest computer scientists in the world are working on that, but I'm not holding my breath, and we certainly can't wait for them to succeed, because they might not succeed. They probably won't succeed in order to secure ICT, or information communication systems. So I'll skip this. There's other quantum algorithms and algorithmic paradigms. There's the good old, you know, what Feynman thought of in the first place. Why not build a quantum computer to simulate another quantum system? So you can simulate the evolution of Hamiltonians, you know, Hamiltonians that are polynomial number of terms acting on a small number of subsystems. We can efficiently simulate their evolution. And people are just starting to figure out, like, okay, but what problem would I actually work on? Like, who would pay money for this? What real problem would it solve? And so it hasn't been a lot of work, but a little bit, a lot of work in the last, okay, in the relative scheme, a lot of work in the last 5 years compared to the previous 20, but it's still not enough. And then Harrow, Hasidim, and Lloyd built on some work on eigenvalue estimation and so on, and showed how for some very special, well-conditioned, sparse linear systems, there could be an immense speed-up. Again, it's a lot of work now to see which real-world problems, or which problems, period, actually have all the right properties so they actually get a speed-up. But it's certainly a really promising tool that's been discovered here. And there's many, there's the adiabatic paradigm, topological algorithms, and so on. There's a couple old surveys, a less old survey. This is like less than 2 years old by Ashley Montanaro at Bristol. Or you can just go to Stephen Jordan's webpage, tries to keep track of all the quantum algorithms. I guess I'm pointing this out to say, a lot of people say there's only two algorithms, Shor and Grover, searching and factoring. It's not true. It's unfair. It's hard to compete with those two because they're so broadly, you know. But if that's the bar to be interesting, that you have to decimate ICT, then okay, then there isn't much interesting going on anywhere for the most part. So I think that bar is a little too high. There's a lot of interesting work that's been developed. So the implications. So now I'll just pull out a. I got a little bit technical earlier. I'll just tell you a little bit of what I tell people who are interested in cybersecurity. Public key crypto is effectively broken because it's not, you can't just go to a larger key. There are now polytime attacks on these schemes. So for RSA or elliptic curve based public key crypto, really effectively 0 bits of security. Symmetric key crypto, the security strength is roughly cut in half. It's not quite so bad, but almost. So symmetric key crypto, we know what to do. We go to a larger key. It's easier said than done in practice. So even that takes years of planning.
Can you say again what is the difference between public and symmetric?
So in symmetric key crypto, Alice and Bob have the same key.
So they change the key just between them?
They somehow share this key. I mean, so assuming they have a shared key, then they encrypt and decrypt with the same shared key.
Public is something that someone, the third party, provides.
Well, no, public is something where you pick a public and private key. They're two different numbers, and you broadcast your public key,
okay,
effectively on your web page or however.
Mm-hmm.
But the secret key you keep secret.
Okay.
And then, let's say I want to send you a message. I want to make sure only you can read it. I encrypt it with your public key.
I see.
And only the person with the private key can read it. Now, in practice, that's not what we do. What we do is we use our public-private keys. The message I would send you would be a secret key to use in a symmetric key scheme. Because the symmetric key schemes are a lot faster.
Sure.
And they're generally more secure.
So that was a basic review that I also forgot how public private works. So
yeah.
Basically, you have public and private key, you generate both, you broadcast public.
Yeah.
Public allows someone to encrypt a message for your eyes only.
Yeah.
Your private key decrypts the message encrypted with the public key.
Yeah. And it also does the reverse, where you can encrypt the message with your private key and send it out, and people know it must have come from you, because the public key decrypts it. So then who could encrypt messages that the public key decrypts? Well, only you, right? So it allows key agreement, and it also allows authentication.
I see.
Which you just can't do with symmetric key crypto.
Okay.
But there is a challenge of how do I know that's really mean as public key and not somebody, So you need an authentic channel to distribute the public keys. But that's a lot easier than a private channel. Like, it's one thing for you to, you could give your public key to your, trusted people and say, please disseminate it. You're just trusting that they don't change it,
yes,
right? But you're not trusting them with your secret key, which is actually protecting your secret. So it's a pretty powerful thing to leverage an authentic channel and turn it into a secret channel. Like, that's a huge upgrade. But you do have to somehow get an authentic channel. Without authenticity, then you really can't be secure.
You're saying all of public-private key encryption is just being completely by the quantum computer.
All that's currently deployed. Okay, with minor exceptions. There are alternatives, like the lattice-based schemes based on short vectors in a lattice, finding elliptic curve isogenies, decoding certain error-correcting codes.
Are those hugely more computationally intensive in the application?
That's a great question. They used to be. They're getting closer, but they're still in general, not always, but in general, the keys are much larger. Like something, right now something's got to give in that the keys are really big you know, it takes a long time to sign something, but we're bringing it down, but our problem is it's not more efficient than the current stuff. So there's a huge resistance to deploying this new stuff because you lose performance somehow. So apart from just the pain of having to go to something new, I also, it's not better. Like, it's worse in performance. So it's hard enough to take something that works and replace it with something that's better in every single way. But now you want me to switch to something that's actually going to be worse in some important ways.
But I mean,
it's a huge
issue we force, right?
Yeah, but that's a tomorrow problem, and the human nature doesn't seem to care so much about anticipating big problems in the future. So these, between the public and private key crypto, I mean, this underpins everything, right? Secure web browsing, auto updates, VPNs, secure email, blockchain, which is essentially all of ICT.
Sorry, what are the different colors?
Yellow is sort of these primitives I've been talking about. No, I give talks to the business community or government. Most people don't know what this means. And they're like, okay, so what? It's like, well, you've heard of secure web, you know, these are things they've heard of. And they all underpin everything, like the internet, e-health, the payment systems, like global payments. None of this will work if these tools don't work.
The big circle relies on the small circle.
Yeah, depend on. I mean, it's more like these are foundational tools. Yeah, that's exactly it. So an argument I started articulating for the last 10 years now, just to get people to understand, you can't wait till we've successfully built a quantum computer. Is the following. You know, first of all, what's the security shelf life of your information? X years. How long will it take you to migrate to a new system? Y years. Right? Now for the next Y years, you're stuck with RSA and ECC. You're supposed to be providing X years of security, but if X plus Y is bigger than Z, you're not. Right? So like nothing happens tomorrow. But you know that in a few years, these last few encryptions are not going to be secure for X years. And it's totally, you know, the logic is unassailable. People know it takes 10 years or so, 5 to 15 years, depending on the complexity of your system. But still nothing really happens in the short term.
Security shelf life is like something that I encrypt today and publicly broadcast. How worried would I be if that would have become public in X years?
Yeah, so you might be, you know, some regulations say this must be secret for 7 years.
And then
you go to jail if you divulge, if you're negligent.
The encrypted message is public, safe somewhere, and someone's just waiting to encrypt it.
Yeah, the record now, decrypt later. Yeah, attack.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, and I tell people, you know, if Y is bigger than Z, then systems collapse. And don't rush. Don't think, well, I can always take some shortcuts. No, because if you take shortcuts, there'll be many mistakes, and then you have many more heartbleeds and other flaws. So when people ask me, when is a quantum computer going to break RSA, most scientists say, well, we don't know. But that's useless because then they ignore it, right? But we don't want to say something false. So what I try to estimate is, first of all, how big of a quantum computer do you need? And then how long will it take us to build such a computer? And there's many stages between, you know, something like Shor's algorithm. You compile it into a circuit. Shor says, you know, multiply these two numbers. Okay, you need a circuit for doing that. Then you have to compile that to fault-tolerant gates, right? And from the bottom, you have a physical system. You use quantum control to get me physical qubits, and you plug them into a fault-tolerant algorithm to deliver some finite set of fault-tolerant gates. These are all algorithms that we keep optimizing and improving along the way. I'm going to skip over the threshold theorem. Right, so right now, the best known fault tolerance ways to achieve fault tolerance are using what are called surface codes. So a number of the thought leaders in this area have worked here or continue to work here. But essentially, a lattice of physical qubits, and these red and blue lines, this is just shorthand for certain operations you're going to do to the neighbors of these red and blue lines. But, so one, two qubits is going to be encoded as dozens or even hundreds of physical qubits. Something like a controlled knot will translate into hundreds and thousands of pulses, implementing controlled knot gates and so on.
So the fault tolerance comes from the fact that each qubit is essentially internally copied a number of times, and like the chance of the overall state flipping is exponentially suppressed.
Yeah. So yeah, these fundamental bits and these operations are faulty. To within, we hope to within 0.01% or lower. If we achieve that in such an architecture where everything is that and it's scalable and so on, then we have good codes that will work and implement. So I can talk about C-naught gates at the logical level, and there'll be this hardware that implements it. And then, so something I've been working on for many, many years is reducing at the algorithmic level how many qubits you actually need. So right now we think a few thousand logical qubits are enough, but maybe we can make that lower. So there's a number of works, and recently, anyway, we came up with a log n to the 2/3 qubit algorithm. It runs in sub-exponential time, so it's not really practical, but it means asymptotically we can do better than today's number field sieve with much fewer than log n qubits. So a number of results. So it's a constantly downward moving curve in terms of how many qubits do you need. And we've also, so that's at the top level, come up with a better algorithm. Then methods for compiling your circuits with Hadamard gates and so on into fault-tolerant circuits, we've been developing the tool, the mathematical and software tools. I think I talked about some of these before in some of the other seminars, but very deep mathematics. And you know, some of it, you know, Peter Sarnak became very interested in a few years ago. We had a workshop a few months ago in California related to the one qubit unitary synthesis. So mathematically, I know you give me any one qubit rotation and then give me two fault tolerant qubit gates. I want precision epsilon. I know there's a string of log 1 over epsilon of these gates that achieve your desired gate with precision epsilon. Except the best known algorithms 7 years ago or so took log 1 over epsilon to the 3rd or 4th. So only polynomial, but that was a huge blow up. Something that should be doable with 50 gates took 100,000 gates, for example. And we came up with a constructive way to get the information theoretic minimum, which shaves off a lot of overhead in building these quantum computers. And that used some algorithmic number theory. Another thing we tried to do is, you know, ended up, so these T gates, these are just phase gates of this form. Really simple to implement at the physical level, but to do fault tolerantly under most schemes is an enormous overhead. So you want to minimize the number of T gates.
When you say overhead, you mean
to do fault tolerantly.
No, sorry, but when you use the word overhead, do you actually mean the effort going into constructing the physical widget?
Yes, but I mostly mean and how many qubits, how many physical qubits do I need? I'm glossing over a lot of stuff. So to implement the T gates, you need to introduce additional ancillary qubits and special states and so on. So there's a huge physical cost. Ultimately, it's a physical cost overhead. So it's not just one physical qubit. You're going to need hundreds and thousands and many, many operations to achieve the T gate. So the cost, the physical cost of achieving a T gate is 1 to 2, maybe more orders of magnitude more expensive than a C-naught gate using surface codes. So we wanted mathematical tools for minimizing the number of T gates, the depth of the T, you know, how many, you know, a row of T gates takes as much time as one T gate. So can I minimize how many layers of T gates I need? And we ended up using matroid, it ended up being a partitioning problem. So we used matroid partitioning algorithms for doing that. And we reduced another optimization to decoding Reed-Muller codes from classical error correction. So all different mathematical tools being applied to the goal of optimally synthesizing these circuits. So I want to make sure I get to this part, because I think, how close are we to having these quantum resources? I would urge you to look at, you know, Shulkov-Devorez's paper on the 7 stages to building a quantum computer. The most critical one is achieving a logical memory that is less noisy than the physical memory. And, you know, there's already some people doing nice work on stages 5, 6, 7, which is, okay, now I got one working qubit. How do I get 2, 4, 100, 1,000 of them in a scalable system? So there's people from England and in Google. And in the last 6 to 8 months, many top groups have been working on not just designing, but building the designs of these scalable fault-tolerant systems. So these are sub-pieces of those surface codes I was alluding to earlier. This is the Yale group, and they're looking at all the engineering as well as physics aspects of being able to scale it later. Right, so they're looking at the wiring and so on, and how do you glue these things together? And it's not just the same, this is just a sampling. New groups are joining the game, like our friends in China. They went from 0 qubits last July that we knew of to 1 last August to 10. Right? They caught up to Google, which had 9 at that point in the public literature. Matteo here at Waterloo is working on multi-layer superconducting circuits as well.
To go from 0 to something.
A lot of money and a lot of people who know what they're doing. So this is the same person who did the quantum satellite. Well, he leads the team. I mean, obviously he has professors running these various projects, but they just, they've built up a pool of people and it's amazing. But a lot of the money helps in the mandate, and it's a mission-oriented thing. So it's, because you can work backwards and say, I need these 10 things. And if you have to do it in the traditional environment, you keep applying for grants and you get 7 out of 10 of the things you need, and it takes forever. But instead, you're given, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars, just get it done. Well, you can work on everything you need. And you don't, you know, yeah. So it's not just the current groups, so there's more and more groups joining the fray. And And they're achieving great things. So the skeptics who think, well, this will take forever, it's like cold fusion, I really don't see the objective. I mean, it's a really bad analogy, the cold fusion analogy. And I'm seeing a lot of progress.
Wait, people actually use the cold fusion analogy?
Yeah.
No, cold fusion has other problems.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but I just, it's just a bad analogy because it doesn't extend.
I think as physicists, we might have a thing to say about
it. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a bad analogy.
Well, cold fusion can happen, just you have to.
Well, there's a performance benchmark there that you want to take more energy out than you put in, among other things. So when you integrate all that, like, so we don't know is the correct answer. And 20 years ago, I said it'll take at least 20 years before we have a clue. And then a couple years ago, I was saying, look, this is like this could happen in a decade. Probably not, but it could happen in a decade. And I think more likely than not in 15 years. Sorry?
You said 10.
How many do we have?
No, I'm just trying your prediction from 96.
Yeah.
That far off.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
It's really how smoothly this probability goes. I'd say the probability is either 0 or 1.
No, it isn't. I mean, because it depends on. It's not. I mean, it depends how whether you think everything's deterministic, but it really depends on how much investment and who works on it and how lucky they are.
So, who's putting the most amount of money into right now? Is it China?
Well, in quantum computing, it's traditionally been North America and Europe and different approaches. And China really wasn't on the map in terms of.
But
quantum computers,
like
leading in the quantum communication was amazing, but I didn't really see a lot of qubit work. I mean, theory, sure, but in terms of the top superconducting or ion trap groups and so on, and I wasn't seeing.
But
I mean,
does it mean that they've essentially caught up now? No.
I mean, in superconducting qubits, it's pretty close, if not, yeah. But there's other platforms as well.
I mean, this derivative is incredible, right? So, like, what we're seeing, I mean, this is as an outsider, but from what you've told me, here's Europe and America, it's grand, it's progress, it's very nice, and here's China with zero, and then money, and like that's the derivative.
Yeah.
So is that in any way, will they be up, will they be the best in the world next year?
It could. I don't know, it might take more than a year, but not much more. Right. It really depends on how quickly we start doing the mission, and maybe we already are, and it's not all, some of it might be, obviously, I'm sure some of it is, you know, not public. But you know, this is, like, there's a fundamental research part, which we, again, do not disrupt that, we need that, because a lot of these obstacles they might encounter in 5 or 10 or 15 years will need real fundamental physics to solve. So you gotta keep feeding the goose, laying the golden eggs. But to build these devices, it's really, you need a more mission-oriented approach, of course. And so I think things keep moving along in the right direction. So I think the odds of it happening within a decade have gone up. And Microsoft also suggested a couple years ago that you could have 100 logical qubits within a decade. It seems feasible. Everyone's using vaguer language than me, but I'd like to give the risk managers something concrete to put in their models.
What is the classical computer do now in terms of bits? What is the biggest amount of? Yeah, I mean, is there a comparison? There's no direct comparison that way, right?
I mean, if you build
in 1 year with a classical computer, 100 logical bits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when would we be able? Yeah, I guess the question I'm asking, given your extrapolations, when do you think a quantum computer will surpass a classical?
Well before this, like well before this, right?
Like only for decoding, only for decoding.
Because this is for decoding. This is for breaking. This is for breaking RSA. And this needs like thousands of logical bits. But I would think with 100 logical bits, we will surpass classical computation. Now, there's people who think we don't even need logical bits to surpass classical computation. We could maybe integrate 50 to 100 physical layer qubits. Just keep the noise down low enough so errors don't kill us. And I mean, they might be right, they might be wrong. I don't know. I'm not so convinced, and I'm not so convinced it matters. It'll matter for intellectual purposes, because they'll have demonstrated that this audacious prediction of quantum theory, that there's this exponential power lurking within physics, but we didn't realize it. We've never proven that in the lab, right? So I think a lot of my colleagues who are pursuing this, the non-fault-tolerant approach, they're trying to prove something very important. It may have practical applications, but this slightly slower track that we're much more confident will work, we will achieve this quantum advantage well before we break RSA 2048. So that could happen soon.
So if one thinks of a quantum computer, it's essentially always some type of hybrid that has a big classical part as well,
yeah,
and then a small quantum core.
Yeah. Volume-wise, it's probably 99% classical, right? I mean, you're going to have, and that's true of even our modern-day computers. Like, the RAM is is one part of the memory, and then most of our information is stored in much cheaper memory. So there's different flavors. There's GPU. There's different types of bits depending on what you're doing. And quantum is a very, very, very niche, only has very few useful applications. So we envisage it being just a coprocessor.
So there would be a quantum processor for specific purposes
I would bet that the first few generations of quantum computers, you custom build the hardware to solve a problem. Of course, they're general, eventually you'll have a more general purpose computer you reprogram in software. But I would imagine the first few computers, if there really was a specific use case, you would probably engineer it. Like, I don't know, it really depends on the system. Like, it might be you have to synthesize your chip to factor a specific number, right? Or you synthesize a chip to factor, right? And then you software encode the number. Or eventually you just synthesize a chip and you run an arbitrary algorithm on it. So I think in the first generation, we're gonna have more customized chip production. But then once we get...
But that really kind of tr- translating current code into also containing some quantum aspects to accelerate or to exploit quantum properties that have not, that there's no universal framework yet where you could kind of.
That's like way too high level.
Yeah.
Like, well, this all sounds like 1950s classical computing,
yeah.
Right? In the 1950s, you would like, oh, I want to integrate, you know, a trajectory. Wow! And then you like sit there and you wire for 3 hours and you put it in program by connecting wires. That's like you program one of those old computers, right? And then you press go and then out comes a punch card and then you read it and that's
yep.
the result. And then you have to rewire everything. Like, it sounds like
yeah.
that analog.
So part of what my group's doing and what I'm really urging people to focus on is all the software and classical hardware that's has to go around these qubits and make sure that's ready to hit the ground running as the fundamental qubits start working. And I think there's a huge commercialization opportunity for us in that space. And so my friend Simon Benjamin at Oxford, I asked him to give a talk last week in London. He speculated in his talk that if somebody's willing to go Manhattan Project and pay put up $30 billion, then it could even take 6 to 12 years to factor a large number. So as I mentioned earlier, what most people are working on are these conventional quantum resistant algorithms based on these alternative problems. That will be the backbone, because you don't need special hardware. From your smartphone to some server, it doesn't matter. IoT, as long as you can store and process bits. Then there is quantum crypto, which I alluded to. They actually work very well together. There's a bizarre tension at times between the communities, but I'm trying to get people to focus on working together and taking advantage of the strengths of each. The biggest challenge to preparing our infrastructure to not be decimated by a quantum computer is not the scientific one. It's just not a hasn't become a priority, because the consequences of doing nothing, there's no consequences in the next 5 years, really. So then not enough of the planning and the long-term planning is happening. It's in very few people's job description to come up with a plan. It's starting to change now, actually, in the last few months. But you still hear that, oh, I'm not going to do anything because my vendors are going to take care of this for me. But have you talked to your vendors? Well, no. Well, okay, they're maybe not going to take care of it for you. Or some people think, let NIST, which is major standards body, standardize a few quantum resistant algorithms in the early 2020s. I mean, that's the plan. Just do nothing until then. Like, why bother until they have the algorithms? And then once you have the algorithms, then we'll all be okay. But I think that's a big mistake. There's a lot of preparation to be done to be ready to use those algorithms. Some people just say, well, give me a new code, and I'll deploy it now and get you off my back. That's a mistake, too, because whatever you deploy today is probably not going to be secure in the long term. So you don't want to make the same mistake and bake in. Because the challenge is, it's really, really hard to change your system. Like, mathematically, it's easy. I just, on the whiteboard, just replace F with F prime, and we're done. But in practice, it can take years, over a decade, to transition from one algorithm to another. So getting it over with and just baking in something else that will be really, really hard to change is a big mistake. People are often waiting to create the business and political case to do something. They're waiting for the cyber Pearl Harbor, right? But that's, I think, very dangerous. Because in a cyber world, like, it's very cheap. I mean, imagine if Pearl Harbor attacks were scalable and cheap, right? And then how are you supposed to recover from this? Anyway, some nice articles here. So ironically, some people don't want to use these new tools because they're risk averse. They don't want to try new stuff. But then you can't ignore this huge threat if you're risk averse. So they have to do both. You have to keep today's tools, which are very reliable against today's attacks, and layer in these new protections. We prepared another thing. I've been with Douglas Stebel at McMaster. We made a lot of these codes available open source. We have an open source platform for these new algorithms, so people can do the testing and the planning and so on, the prototyping, have reference implementations without doing, because there's only a handful of people in the world who could reliably implement this crypto. So often, the rare time I would get a company say, oh, I understand, I believe you, what do I do? Then I'd realize, well, nothing, because you can't implement your own crypto, you'll mess it up in most cases, or it'll be far too expensive for one company. So we started this open source platform, sort of like an open SSL for quantum resistant algorithms. My friend Thomas Yenevine is part of the quantum space race, recently funded. some great news. You know, the US, they're working on optical networks. As Mina alluded to earlier, there's a resistance to using QKD in practice. One fundamental reason is there's this much faster, cheaper, easier stuff to do that is based on alternative math problems. The main downside is there's a risk that they get cryptanalyzed, whereas quantum cryptography, you can't cryptanalyze it. If you want to break it, you have to somehow break a physical assumption. So there's a long dialogue, the pros and cons of using QKD and so on that I'm engaged in. Part of our recent work is one of the many challenges of people taking QKD seriously is, you know, people who work at the top level of the protocol stack, who work on applications and security architecture, they usually don't worry about the hardware. And when you talk about QKD, we start with the hardware, and they're like, well, I don't understand that stuff, and I don't know, I wouldn't know what to do with that, I don't know where to plug it in, how it works, and you're kind of spooking them, in a sense, and scaring them away. So we've been articulating, four-layer architecture to using QKD, and the quantum stuff's just in the bottom layer. The top three layers are essentially software, and more closely resemble what they probably are used to seeing. Another thing I try to articulate to people is, this is a really historic opportunity. Usually we don't fix things until they're actually broken. But then in this case, it'll be far too late. I mean, it'd be very devastating if we wait for something so fundamental to be broken that takes 10 years to fix. That's a very, very, you know, terrible scene. This quantum threat gives us a chance to rebuild our cyber foundations. And the truth is, people are worried about our cyber foundations, their resistance to other attacks as well. So some people who maybe couldn't care less about quantum attacks like the idea that we're having a chance to rebuild our cryptographic foundations better than they were before. There are glimmers of hope. Things are moving in the right direction. Like the US NSA announced that it, for selling crypto tools, cyber tools to the government, they are eventually going to transition to these quantum resistant algorithms. NIST started a post-quantum crypto project in order to deliver such standardized algorithms, and a number of people in Waterloo and around the world are working on this. Last year at the conference, ETSI is a European Telecommunications Standards Institute. They developed GSM, for example. We've been working with them for many years, and we started a workshop series together 5 years ago. The last one was just last week in London. It got some nice press coverage in the Wall Street Journal and IT World Canada. The last one we hosted in Toronto, and we got these great quotes from the chief and deputy chief of the CSE, which is the lead cryptologic agency in Canada. So it's creating awareness, and getting word out. And, you know, that sends a different, like, to first order, they're not saying anything that the academics weren't saying 5 years ago, but it carries a lot more weight when leaders of industry and government are saying, no, really, this is a problem. So things are moving in the right direction. So I'll just wrap up there. I think what's been motivating me, I mean, I started in crypto, very worried about the threat that quantum offered, also excited by the opportunity. We want to seize the opportunity, but for it not to be a catastrophe, we do need to replace the foundations of our cybersecurity with stuff designed to resist quantum attacks. So sorry for going over time. Thanks for all the questions. Happy to continue over lunch whenever.